Welcome to Digging In, Unearthing Stories of Climate Adaptation, a Lynx podcast series. I'm Cara LeBlanc. If you had asked me a year ago how political studies and climate change are connected, I wouldn't have been able to give you an answer. Jonathan Sears is an associate professor of international development and political studies. He welcomed me into his office here at Canadian Mennonite University, where we settled down next to shelves filled with books and artifacts from his time in different African countries. John reassured me that he was excited to answer all of my questions. With the Lynx Project, John is focusing on policy. That means meeting with leaders at all kinds of levels.
Everything that happens on the ground in the context of the projects that the partners are implementing and that the things that Mennonite Central Committee is doing on the ground, all those things take place within the context of bylaws at the local level and then legislation through the provincial level all the way up to national level policies.
Zimbabwe's policy environment is a unique blend of local and legislative processes.
So governance here is construed very broadly to include everything from, again, those bylaws and practices and norms at the local level that maybe aren't codified in law, but arise from other kinds of local knowledge or traditional knowledge, as well as things that do arise or kind of emerge from the local context and inform bylaws and legislation and acts of parliament around all the things that are related to climate change adaptation.
John explained to me that there are few policies in Zimbabwe that have to do with climate change directly. But even though they don't name it formally, many of the policies that he is looking at still have an impact on how Zimbabweans are adapting to climate change. Current policies might be helping adaptation, while others may be making it harder.
You see it in other policies that maybe don't have climate change adaptation written at the top of them, right? So things that are in legislation and acts that govern, resource management, that govern land allocation, all the way down to the Traditional Leaders Act, for example, which establishes the range of powers and responsibilities that traditional leaders have. And that's a pretty interesting example, I think, in part because it kind of really is at this intersection of how traditional leaders are empowered by their roles that they get through traditional means, inheritance, and other kinds of things related to traditional knowledge, but they also have roles that are set out in national legislation. And so at the local level, those leaders, as an example, have certain kinds of responsibilities for their communities, which includes both the people, but also the non-human people, we might say, right? The livestock, the animals, the plants, the whole ecosystem. And so I guess if we could ask that question there, you could say, well, is the act as it exists, as it defines traditional leaders' roles, is it supporting what they're doing or what they need to be doing to help with a climate change adaptation? Or are there things in an act like that that are maybe a little bit outdated or maybe don't reflect kind of current realities in the communities?
Policies outline priorities. Sometimes these priorities reflect the reality for a community, but sometimes there can be a disconnect.
If they do kind of skirt the rules, so what, right? How does that matter? Who does it matter to? So these are all the kinds of questions that relate to decision making, who's making decisions about all the related things, about access to resources, land, water, fodder, pasture, forest resources. Who's making decisions about those, and then who's included in the conversation about how those sorts of decisions and those sorts of questions of allocation are made. You know, the kind of most basic level governance is about who gets what, when, where, and how, right? It's also a way of thinking about and talking about how communities from the very local up to the national set priorities, right? And say, hey, here's six things. We can't do all six. How do we figure out which three are the most important now and which three are we going to have to do later?
So how might John's research impact Zimbabweans?
You know, I'm not going to tell somebody in the Zimbabwean Ministry of X, Y, or Z how they should change their policy. That's not my role, right? My role as a researcher is to work alongside Zimbabweans, folks who are connected to the projects, to be able to help build their capacity and help give them, you know, support, you know, analysis, ideas, if I have any, about how what their reality looks like, you know, kind of from the outside perspective, right? And if that can be helpful for them, then they can take that and do that advocacy work themselves because they're Zimbabwean citizens advocating to their own, you know, village level authorities or local chief or district level or provincial or national level folks, right? And there's already, you know, many non-governmental organizations working specifically on climate responsiveness policy and advocacy around a lot of the issues that we're also interested in and working with.
And while John works at understanding policy impacts, it's people like Molly Moyo, a beekeeper in Gwanda District, that he has in mind. With the drought, farming has become a lot harder for Zimbabweans. Many people have found other sources of income that use less water. One emerging option is beekeeping. When we visited Molly's home in the Gwanda District in southwestern Zimbabwe, she greeted us with a warm smile that rarely left her face. Our conversation was hosted by Guguletu Nyati, project officer from Brethren in Christ Compassionate and Development Services. Molly spoke in her local language in Ndebele, and Guguletu was our translator.
It's just, it's a passion for her, and it's also determination. She enjoys it, she likes it.
Although it might use less resources, beekeeping is still impacted by climate change.
Before the season changed, before the climate changed, a box would give her about 30 liters of honey, and then she would package them in smaller 375 ml bottles that she would go and sell in Gwanda. She did used to survive through the bees, but it was much better prior to the seasons changing. Yeah.
Other changes have also influenced how much Molly can rely on beekeeping for income.
And she's saying, unfortunately, with the change in currencies, it's difficult to monetize it, but she was able to send her children to school through the bee production.
Honey production continues to have a positive impact on her life.
She's saying she's fascinated by the boxes. You know, when you open the boxes and you see the combs, she's fascinated by that. And she also likes the fact that honey is medicinal. It heals people, children who are coughing and all that. So she's fascinated by that. She enjoys that.
For Molly, this isn't just about her business. She has a bigger vision for her community and is happy to share her knowledge with her neighbors.
She also likes and what she envisions is she likes it when her, this area or her place or the ward is known for keeping bees. So that motivates her. And she really has a vision, or her hope is that they'll be able to mass produce bees, and the world outside will know that go to Ward 4, you are going to get honey.
Adapting to climate change has a huge impact on income generation. Often families will need to be involved in multiple livelihoods. I was happy to hear that despite the challenges, Molly enjoys her work, which surely lightens the load at least a little bit. Talking to John helped me see how much climate change adaptation is connected to policy work. By discussing policies with local, regional, and national leaders, John comes alongside Zimbabweans. The potential is there to notice barriers that might be making climate change adaptation harder and affirm areas that help. Perhaps someday the work John is doing will make work easier for people like Molly. Thank you to my guests, Jonathan Sears, Associate Professor of International Development and Political Studies at Canadian Mennonite University, Molly Moyo, beekeeper in the Gwanda district, and Gugula Tuniati, project officer at Brethren in Christ Compassionate and Development Services. Digging In, Unearthing Stories of Climate Adaptation was written and produced by Kara LeBlanc, with story editing by David Balser and mixing assistance by Daryl Neustetter-Barg. Thanks for listening. I'm Kara LeBlanc. Lynx is a multi-year Mennonite Central Committee project helping climate-affected populations in Zimbabwe adapt to the changing environment. CMU is one of three research partnerships working alongside two Zimbabwe-based research partners and three local development organizations working across three districts. Lynx is administered in partnership with the Government of Canada and with funding from other generous donors.
All Lynx is locally led, indigenous, nature-based solutions for climate change adaptation in Zimbabwe. All Lynx is locally led.